Back chat.
Politics and current affairs.
Back chat.
Your alternative to talk back.
Yes, indeed. You are listening to Backchat here on FBI Radio, your freshest wrap of news and current affairs. I'm Swetha Das.
And I'm Shami Sivasubramanian. This week in the news, we've seen Boris Johnson fighting to save his Brexit deal with the EU and an enormous boa constrictor at large in the centre of Sydney. But as always, we're going to be giving you the news you might not have heard on your airwaves this week.
First up, we have Edward Miller, a campaigns director for economic fairness at GetUp, about the Universal Jobs Guarantee Initiative and what we can expect from it.
After that, we'll be speaking to Natalie Shahata, the founder and editor of Tommy Magazine, to speak to us about the pitfalls of the ever-growing fast fashion industry and what we can do to be more sustainable in our pursuit of fashion-forward dressing.
And as always, we want to hear from you. Do you love Fashion Nova? Is it problematic to love Fashion Nova? Text us in and smite Cardi B on 0409-945-945 or tweet us at BackchatFBI.
To show us all what a beep lying, beep backstabbing, beep treacherous, beep beep she is. Thanks, Colin.
Backchat, your alternative to talk back.
Did you know that currently 700,000 people in Australia are actively looking for a job and are unable to find one in a market that has only 200,000 vacancies?
Not only that, but a further 1 million Australians want to work more paid hours than they're being offered.
We have Edward Miller, a campaigns director for economic fairness at GetUp, here with us today to discuss the possibility of a universal job guarantee initiative in Australia and what that might mean for the future of our employment. Hi there, Edward. With.
Good morning. It's so good to be here.
Thank you for coming on the show. Let's just get back to basics. What exactly is a universal job guarantee?
Well, as you said, there's hundreds of thousands of people looking for work in Australia right now, and there's only there's fewer job vacancies available for them. A job guarantee would see the government guarantee well-paid employment to anybody who's willing and able to work across the country.
So what would be some of the essential features of an initiative like that?
I mean, there's quite a few, and there's lots of different ways that you could implement a job guarantee. But a couple of the key things that distinguish it from other kinds of job programs are that it's entirely voluntary. So it's not like Work for the Dole, where you kind of get coerced into doing these mutual obligations and crappy work in order to just receive your New Start allowance. It's also something that pays a living wage and comes with all of the other benefits of full-time work. So you get your sick leave, you get your annual leave. Obviously, that's all done pro rata, based on how much you're working or, you know, how long you're working for. But those basic entitlements that full-time employees can expect in the labour market are all there as well. And I think another key one is that it's work that's focused on people and on communities. So this isn't a punishment for being unemployed, like a lot of our current income support system is. It recognises that people being locked out of work is a market failure, not a personal failure. And so it focuses on giving them jobs that are good for their development, or, you know, helping them get that next apprenticeship and paying them well to do that, seeing that as the kind of recognition of their contribution to society.
So what is the extent of unemployment in Australia at the moment? Has it improved in the past few years?
Yeah, it's a big question. It's also complicated. So you were saying before that there's over 700,000, it's about 740,000 people who are currently unemployed in Australia, according to the ABS. But that number's kind of misleading, because unemployment on that figure alone means that you're working less than 1 hour a week and that you're actively seeking work. And so there's two groups of people that it excludes. There's people who are working a few hours a week, you know, picking up, you know, a couple of hours as an Uber driver, but looking for full-time employment and not really able to pay the bills on that kind of casual labour. And there's also another group of people that's excluded because they've given up looking for work. You know, the job market seems so ominous, it seems so unappetizing, that they've lost confidence that they'll ever be able to find a job, and so they've stopped looking, and the ABS no longer counts them as unemployed. So all up, we're looking at about 1.8 to 2 million people who are either unemployed or underemployed and actively seeking more work.
Wow.
So your work at GetUp focuses on a universal job guarantee rather than a youth job guarantee. So why this word choice?
Well, there's no question that young people are doing it really tough right now. The unemployment rate in Australia is about 5.2%. People under the age of 24 have an unemployment rate of about 11.7%. So it's almost twice the national average for unemployment. And in some areas like central and northern Queensland, youth unemployment is up to 26.5%. So one in four people looking for work can't find it. But what we're actually seeing is that there's a growing number or growing proportion of the unemployed pool who are actually over the age of 50. And that's as a result of a number of different factors. It's often age discrimination. It's often sectoral change in the economy that means that industries that people have given their entire life to are going out of business or becoming uncompetitive. And people lack the support. They lack the accessibility of retraining programs to find their way into new paths of employment. And that has massive consequences for people. To give you one example, the fastest growing population of unemployed of homeless people in Australia are women over the age of 55, because they've been locked out of paid employment. They're not yet able to access the pension or their superannuation for free. And oftentimes they have less superannuation than their male counterparts. And so they dip into those super savings, but they still can't afford to meet the bills and they're ending up on the streets or sleeping rough.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5 FM with Swetha Das and Shami Sivasubramanian. We're speaking to Edward Miller, Senior Campaigner for Economic Fairness from GetUp, about the possibility of a universal job guarantee, an initiative that would see Australians get a job or an education. So we've spoken to the stats. You've just kind of blown our minds, moving 500,000 people all the way to more than a million Australians looking for jobs that simply doesn't exist. So how can we implement the universal job guarantee in a society that isn't organised to hire every single person?
Yeah, it's a big question. And there's lots of like really lengthy academic papers. There's an economist called Bill Mitchell up at the University of Newcastle who has written a 300-page report on how you would, you know, specifically get down into the nitty-gritty of doing this. My perspective is, number one, we've done this before. There are similar programs that exist around the world in places like Argentina's Jefes program. In India, there's a rural job guarantee. Even in Australia in the 1990s, Paul Keating had something called the Working Nation Package that guaranteed employment for long-term unemployed people and halved the rate of people who are long-term unemployed. But, you know, the way that you'd get started is by taking the Department of Human Services and making it into something that actually services humans. Yeah. Like if you just reoriented a lot of those people's jobs, if you just reoriented a lot of those people, instead of, you know, their jobs being to send out robo debts every other day, and instead they're out there looking for, you know, employment opportunities that match the untapped potential of people who are looking with work with the unmet needs of the communities that they live in, that would be a really good start.
So speaking of untapped potential, is this initiative about getting people jobs to just put food on the table, or is it about taking into account a person's career aspirations?
Yeah, I think that there's different people in different circumstances, and an ideal job guarantee scheme will take into account different people in different circumstances. So for instance, a lot of young people who are unemployed, they're not going to want to work on this program forever. They're going to want to see it as a transition into other forms of paid employment in the longer term. And there's ways that you could do that, right? At the moment, apprentices get a raw deal. They get paid often pennies on the dollar of a minimum wage system. What we could be doing is instead having the federal government underwrite a lot more of those apprenticeships in order to kind of push people into trades or skilled work and give people the ability to support themselves while they're doing it. But as I said before, there's a lot of people who are also probably approaching the end of their careers, and they probably just want something that's meaningful, decently paid, that has the security of full-time employment in order to get them to retirement. And that's something that we should approach as well.
So how would you respond to skeptics that say that the government can't afford an initiative like this?
I just refuse to believe that we can spend $300 billion over the next decade on corporate tax cuts, on income tax cuts that will predominantly benefit the wealthy, but we can't afford a program like this. I think that at the moment, one of the things that sort of people balk at when they see you, when they think about kind of big ambitious programs like this, is the price tag of what does a job guarantee cost? But what they're not looking at are all of the individual price tags that come along with unemployment, but that are scattered along different line items in a budget. You know, you've got not just got your income support payments, you've got your increased health costs because people who are unemployed get sicker more frequently. You've got your increased social services costs because people who are unemployed lose skills. You've got the opportunity cost of these people not being able to work and pay tax and have that come back into the budget or spend in their local communities. And I think that if you add up all the current costs that we're paying to keep people unemployed, to keep people locked out of paid work, the cost of a job guarantee isn't going to be very much at all.
Thank you so much for talking to us today, Edward.
No problem. It's been such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. That was Edward Miller, a campaign director for economic fairness at GetUp, speaking to us about the Universal Job Guarantee Initiative and what we could expect from it.
Stay tuned because we'll be moving on to our next interview with Natalie Shahata, the founder and editor of Tommy Magazine, to speak to us about the pitfalls of the ever-growing fast fashion industry and what we can do to be more sustainable in our pursuit of fashion-forward dressing.
But now I'm going to play a song. Here's Sugar Honey Iced Tea by Princess Nokia. And I'm going to play it off YouTube because the system is failing me. But let's see how it goes. Everyone, bear with me. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Backchat here on FBI Radio.
It is absolutely laughable. The woman's off her tree.
Backchat, your alternative to talk back.
The term fast fashion has become a buzzword in recent years, but what does it really mean? And why can't we get enough of it?
Popular clothing websites and apps such as ASOS, Fashion Nova, and Nasty Gal make buying the latest fashions at a percentage of the price a breeze. But what's the real cost?
Natalie Shahata, founder and editor of Tommy Magazine, is here to answer all those questions and more. She'll be taking us through just how the industry has developed, what its impact is on our environment, and how it affects our on-trend trouser pockets. Welcome, Natalie!
Thank you so much for having me.
So, can you help us unpack the term fast fashion?
Yeah, I think that's a really great place to start too, because I think we hear so many words these days about sustainability and greenwashing and, you know, ethics, and I think we need to go back to basics and really understand what is fast fashion. And so I think the idea of fast fashion is, you know, there are these fast fashion brands that are looking to, you know, runways and the catwalk and churning, and I use that word deliberately, churning out these looks and in a really kind of fast-paced way. But we're doing this at the cost of the environment. You know, we're doing this in a way where we're using inferior materials. So polyester is one of these synthetic materials that fast fashion use. I think in 2014, you know, 60% of fast fashion used synthetic fibers. So we're doing that. We're using inferior materials. Garment makers are suffering because they are not getting paid a living wage. And so, yes, we're churning out these looks in a really fast way, and we're compromising the environment and we're compromising humanity. And I know that sounds pretty full on, but that is what we're doing.
That's exactly it. So what sparked your interest in slow fashion?
I have always shopped, I guess, with a conscious outlook. And that was, I guess, because of necessity. So I've always shopped secondhand. Growing up, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, so we couldn't really buy new things. So I've really grown up with this mentality of, you know, use all the resources that are available to you and that already exist type of thing, and make them last as long as possible, which is what this, you know, slow clothing and slow fashion philosophy is all about, you know, using what already exists and extending the life cycle of that. So, yeah, I grew up really, thinking about pre-loved and secondhand clothing and going to markets and flea markets and garage sales and op shopping, and that kind of evolved as I got older into vintage. So yes, that's how it kind of started for me.
So it's interesting to see how slow fashion has transformed over the years. More people are choosing vintage stores and op shops over mainstream brands nowadays. But what is it like to see this transformation?
It's quite interesting because it is, like you say, definitely changing, but I do still feel like we have a long way to go. I think, you know, it's been amazing to see how it's changing, and to see that, you know, rather than looking to the runway and to looking at the catwalk for trends, people are really kind of going back to that element of personal style, which is something that's really important to me. And I think that's the thing, you know, when we talk about fast fashion, it's kind of like you pretty much go out of fashion as soon as you walk out the door, because these fast fashion outlets are getting drops, you know, like Zara, I think, gets drops every single week. Topshop and H&M get drops, you know, almost like, you know, there's 400 new pieces of clothing on their website almost every day. And it's just, yeah, it's kind of a bit mad. So it's really cool to be able to see that people are going back to wanting to look different and wanting to look unique rather than following those fast fashion trends.
So do you think class structures play a role in how people shop, if at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is something we talk a lot about over on the Tommy platform. And, you know, in the industry, we're kind of looking at that nuance a lot more now. People want to, I guess, that the idea of fast fashion is that it's accessible and convenient and that you can gain access to those looks in a really kind of fast way. But I think the thing is, we need to think about the effects of that and the flow-on effect of that. But I mean, you know, my example that I just shared with you ladies just now is that, you know, I was only able to shop secondhand because that's all I could afford. So I think the thing is, you know, and it's not really talked about enough in the industry, is that what's happening now is in op shops, because this idea of secondhand style and recycled fashion and pre-loved clothing is getting so popular, a lot of the op shops are actually quite have increased their prices. So what's happening is people can't even sometimes afford to shop in op shops. So then what they do is they go to these fast fashion chains to be able to gain access to these looks and these trends. So I think that's where, you know, my work with Save the Children kind of comes into play, because they are a charity that, you know, stick to those fundamental values of having access to these looks, because their prices are so affordable. You know, they have really, really affordable pricing.
So could you tell us a bit more, because you've just touched on it, could you tell us a bit more about your work as, okay, get this, Sharmi, this is your title, National Retail Eco Stylist for Save the Children Australia, which sounds like a superhero, but you have touched on it. Tell us a bit more about that.
Definitely not a superhero. I guess for me, I always wanted to prove that fashion wasn't frivolous. You know, it's a $3 trillion industry, and it really does have the power to affect positive change. So I guess I always wanted to prove to people that fashion can be a force for good. And so, you know, I care a lot about the human effects, and I care a lot about children. And I kind of wanted to take that emphasis on the social aspect and coordinate that with fashion. So Save the Children are one of the largest NGOs that help protect the rights of children. And so basically my work is to share secondhand fashion and op shopping as your first alternative and your first kind of preference to shopping new. So I really want to be able to, I guess, communicate that message and let people know that you don't have to compromise style when you're shopping secondhand. And I think that there's still quite a stigma with secondhand clothing. It's slowly changing, but I really want to be able to prove that you don't have to compromise anything when you're shopping secondhand.
Yeah. You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5 FM with Swetha Das and Sharmi Sivasubramanian. We're speaking to Natalie Shahata, the founder and editor of Tommy Magazine, about the pitfalls of fast fashion industry. And we have some texts in.
That's right. One of my friends texted in. I do know she's guilty of this. She does a Pretty Little Thing haul, like, every couple of months. Natalie's face is shocked. And she says that because it's so cheap, it ends up at the back of my closet and I never remember that I bought it.
Yeah.
Isn't that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then we got another text in from Samantha from Paddington. And, oh, they point out something quite interesting, which is Gorman, which is, you know, high fashion, like, yes, good quality materials. But they actually got flack a couple of years ago for, yes, using sweatshops.
Yes. And I think this is where the nuance of the industry comes into play, because I think the thing is, you know, you can, I mean, Gorman are not Australian made, so we need to think about that as well. They are made offshore, but they are, I guess, releasing product very frequently. So we need to also look at that too. You know, you can very much also be an Australian brand and produce onshore, but produce a lot of product. So this is where the nuance of the industry comes into play. And I guess you as a consumer really identifying your personal values and what it is that I guess you want to contribute with and kind of use your dollar, you know, as a way of, yeah, it's like your dollar has a lot of power. Mm. So you've got to decide what, you know, what you want to do with that and the decisions you make and what kind of consumer you want to be. Yeah.
So with that in mind, what then counts as slow fashion? What should we be looking out for as a consumer?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the industry is very confusing, you know, for people that aren't working within the industry. I think it can be very confusing for an outsider to know what slow clothing is and what slow fashion is. I think, you know, when we're looking at slow fashion, you need to think about, you know, the popular term at the moment is like the circular economy and, you know, thinking about that product life cycle too. So brands that kind of design with the end in mind. So what are you going to do with that product? Is it compostable? You know, is it going to biodegrade? And I think that's the thing with fast fashion, you know, when we're using these synthetic fibers, that's actually not going to happen. So I think the slow clothing philosophy also is about, you know, asking brands as well and doing your individual research. So look at the fibers that they use and really identifying, you know, are these natural fibers that they use, the ethics of fashion, who's making your clothing, are they paid, you know, fair wages, and also thinking about how you're going to extend the life cycle of that clothing too. So can this be mended? Can it be repaired? And I think that's, you know, with the slow clothing philosophy, that's kind of what we need to think about.
So vintage stores, op shops, flea markets and garage sales are all good examples.
Yeah.
But is it also possible for mainstream brands to be ethical and sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're seeing so many brands at the moment that are going the distance to make change. I think the thing that's really important for people to realize is that not one brand is going to ever tick everything. So you can very much well be an ethical brand, you know, and have the consideration of paying your workers a fair wage and a living wage, but you may not be using sustainable fibres. And I think the thing is, you know, when people hear about sustainability in fashion, they are so overwhelmed with the research and the statistics, and they assume that all brands are going to tick every kind of shopping criteria, as I like to call it, but they can't do everything, you know. So you can very much have, you know, we have a lot of Australian brands that are doing incredible things, and they're supporting the, you know, Australian manufacturing industry, which is, you know, becoming almost obsolete, but they're not using sustainable fibres. It is really hard for a brand to do everything, and I think that's why it's really important as a consumer to understand what you value and what is important to you. But I mean, there's incredible brands doing fantastic things, and Australia, where, you know, overseas, we are seen as, you know, the leaders in this. So that's really promising.
Well, that's exciting to know.
Yeah.
So you're the founder and editor of Tommy Magazine. Can you tell us a bit more about how that publication came about?
Yeah, I think, gosh, it's like, you know, twofold, threefold. It started because of so many reasons. I'm a stylist by trade, and I guess I really wanted to be able to portray secondhand fashion as this amazing vessel for creativity and self-expression and identity. And I guess, you know, when I started as a stylist 10 years ago, secondhand clothing wasn't popular and it was very much frowned upon. And so I guess I really wanted to be able to provide a platform that celebrated secondhand clothing. Mainstream magazines that I had kind of approached and had wanted to kind of share editorials, creative editorials that I had styled, rejected those fashion editorials because all the pieces were secondhand, because it's not something they could monetize. So I really wanted to be able to elevate secondhand fashion and show people that, you know, It's incredible, you know, you can do so much. There's so much available in op shops, and it really does celebrate, you know, identity and personal style. I guess the other part of it also was that I really wanted to, bring the conversation of diversity and visibility and inclusivity to the mainstream, which, you know, we're using a lot of those words at the moment and it is becoming quite saturated. But, you know, a lot of women of colour were not portrayed in fashion, and that really frustrated me. You know, I was one of the only people in the fashion industry when I was a stylist back then that had kind of an ethnic multicultural background. And I really wanted to be able to showcase the amazing creatives within the fashion industry that weren't getting visibility and access. So, you know, that is changing now. We see that a lot changing, which is fantastic. But I do still feel like we need to do a lot of work in that arena. It is a little bit tokenistic at times. You know, we have a lot of editorial campaigns at the moment with women of colour and different texture and body shapes, but still in the business of fashion, we are having, you know, there is still a majority white person, white woman, you know. And I think we need to see women of colour in these business making decisions.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're hosting an event in Newtown on Wednesday about the true cost of fast fashion and how we can adopt more eco-friendly styles. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a collaboration, yes, with Newtown Festival, and we are raising money for the Newtown Neighbourhood Centre. So 100% of the proceeds from ticket sales go back to helping the Newtown Neighbourhood Centre. We are doing a screening of the True Cost documentary, which, if you haven't seen, is an absolute must. I feel like, you know, when you speak to people about what their kind of catalyst for change was to promote and, I guess, embrace a more sustainable fashion outlook and perspective, it's the True Cost that's kind of really got them over the line.
Yeah.
It is quite hard hitting and it provokes a lot of emotions and feelings, but it's a definite kind of necessary doco to watch. And then we're doing a little intimate panel discussion afterwards that, I guess, showcases a lot of inner West brands and designers and retailers that have been in the industry for a while, and they all have very different business models. And so I often curate these panel discussions so that there is a completely different business model or a different perspective, so that the audience, and we get a lot of designers, upcoming designers that come along to our events, can see that you can embrace sustainability and, I guess, ethical fashion through different mediums. So we have, a great inner West brand called Made 590, and they produce onshore and focus on inclusive sizing, focus on a lot of bright prints and colours. Then we have Swap Clothing Exchange, which is a fantastic retailer in Newtown, and they kind of, you know, you can sell your clothes and get money back or credit. So they've got an incredible kind of secondhand business. Mm-hmm. And then we've got Publisher Textiles, and we also have The Social Outfit as well.
Oh my God. So many places to go to.
So many places.
We'll put details about that on our Twitter.
We will. And thank you so much for talking to us, Natalie. I honestly feel more fashionable by association just having you in the studio right now.
You girls are already fashionable.
Oh my goodness. Oh, stop. That was Natalie Shahada, founder and editor of Tommy Magazine, speaking to us about the pitfalls of the ever-growing fast fashion industry. And that's all the time we have for today. Another big thank you to our producers, Eden Faithful, Natalie Sekulovska, and Pip Leeson. And thanks again to our guests, Natalie Shahada and Edward Miller.
We'll catch you all next week. But before we do, we're going to play a track from an Australian darling. This is Alex the Astronaut's Happy Song. We'll catch you all next week.